With Willie P, and you were listening to One Love, New Editions, One Love. We are talking to Reggie Pittman and Kevin Smith. We have them back on today to talk about, money issues. I like money. But we are also talking about reparation. I hope they talk about that today. And they are talking about Wall Street's and the demise of Black people's success. How did we get to where we were to where we are now? What has happened? And he was talking about policies that happened during the course of our lifetime. Changes, rule changes, eminent domain. Talk about all those issues that happened, and they're still happening to people of color in this nation, where we are not getting our just dessert. So I'm going to shut up, Kevin. So you tell us. Tell us what's going on, you and Reggie.
Yeah, and when you don't get that proper, appropriate, accurate type of compensation, you're going to come out on the lower end, and someone else is going to come out on a bigger end. And so it's a reassignment of wealth to someone who's already got wealth. That's what you're doing. I want to focus a little bit more on land for the next few minutes. And the amount of land that Black people owned in this country. You go back over 100 years ago, Black folk owned about 14% of the land. You know, most people were farmers. How much of the land is owned by Black people today?
And 14% wasn't a lot.
No. But it only got worse.
It only got worse. That's what I'm saying.
And we're less than 1% today, a height of 14%. It would have been close to, 17 million acres.
Oh, 17 million. Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right.
And today is less than 1 million acres. From 17 million high to less than, not even 1 million acres today.
100 acres per person, less than, probably.
Okay, yeah, well, you did the math.
It seems like a lot less than that.
A lot less than that.
Yeah.
Government policy. So again, just like I mentioned the last time we were together, government policy played a major role. There were all kinds of homestead acts throughout the 1800s, the early part of the 1900s. Well, 640 acres if a married couple, or 320 acres. And then when that wouldn't sell that well, let's cut it in half to 160 acres. And you see, by the time they got down to us, they said, we'll give you just 40 acres. Because that was what the government was saying, that that's what they wanted you to at least clear 40 acres to be able to plant, and you can really have a type of a self-sustaining type of an existence. And so a lot of that land loss is still going on because through the heirs' property, okay, that some still have. And so now we'll get the property, we'll get it from you, pay you pittance, and then rezone it, and now it's worth millions. But we're not going to give you the millions. And it's worth millions without even improving it, meaning putting buildings and structures and hotels and resources on it. It's worth millions after they've given you 10,000 here. Same thing with the urban renewal when the decimation of the Black neighborhoods, Black businesses, and things like that. What happened was, okay, we got to relocate you. So we're going to relocate you from here. I'm going to have difficulty going someplace else because of discrimination. I can't move and open a business someplace else. Or I can't get a new loan from the bank because of redlining. So all these constraints, these structural kinds of things that are in place that impede my being able to sustain a reasonable lifestyle.
I would say the government was heavily involved. Things like trickery and unfair treatment under the law and some of the property was lost through violence. That's what we talked on our last segment about the massacre.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly there was over 890,000 farms that belonged to blacks at the turn of this century. And through whatever reason, many more than one or two, that's how blacks lost their property through many reasons. Certainly eminent domain
played a
huge part in the property loss of African Americans at the turn of the century.
And some were perhaps part of a conspiracy, but others were, oh, well, you didn't pay your taxes and you owe a nominal amount, but because you didn't pay it in full,
we want it.
Sort of like how the payday loan thing works today, yeah. A little, you know. So, you got to pay it in full. You can't make a payment. So, the unwillingness to work with the landowner as to paying their taxes, should they have owed some taxes, had some taxes that were outstanding.
And the sharecropper's craziness where you never pay it off. Mm-hmm. You'll never be able to make enough money to get out of that cycle.
Well, and even if we take the farmers' home loan administration, part of the USDA. I mean, a big settlement case that happened a few years ago was Pickford versus Glickman. This was during the Clinton administration, 1997. There was a Pickford 1, Pickford 2. And approximately $2 billion were paid out to black farmers. The National Black Farmers Association was in on that, pushing that effort. So there were farmers who did get settlement. Now, we can argue about whether or not it was just compensation. And part of the settlement was attributed to they were trying to get loans through the USDA, the Farmers Home Loan Administration, and were denied loans. So the white farmer, to get the monies to sustain them through the season, the farm season, and the black farmer couldn't. Or we'll refinance the loan to the white farmer, or we'll give them better terms, or what you got to put up for as collateral.
Right.
Okay, so this whole thing gets to be so complex, and discrimination all
through the
structure,
yes,
of how it's being administered, and clearly since day one. But let me just say this, even with the 70,000 farmers who did get some of the benefit from the settlement, the $2 billion, the estimates was that it should have been $320 billion. So they got $2 billion out of what should have been $320 billion. I don't know. I do some quick math. Is that less than 1%? Is that work? Is that right?
It probably was.
Okay.
Mentally, I'm thinking it was.
Many of them did end up going out of business.
Oh, yeah.
Going out. They couldn't farm any longer.
Couldn't farm.
Yeah.
And we see this happening over and over again. I look in Virginia when I go through Virginia. All that farmland now, apartment buildings.
Mm.
They have taken what we could have had food-wise for the United States doing that. They ship it overseas through whatever that bargaining deal they had back with, I think, was it Clinton, doing Clinton, when everything got started to get outsourced?
Well, I think the last 75 years, I think most of the presidents have had some type of agricultural type arrangements where they're selling massive amounts to other countries.
The demise. And where do you see this going, or where do you see us being in this picture today?
Well, I can briefly talk about where we came from and where we should go.
Okay.
Where we should go is, of course, better employment and property. The powers that be years ago, all these massacres and eminent domain, they knew there were two ways to build wealth, income and property. If you take those two away, it is extremely difficult to build wealth. So during, the 1919, when all those massacres occurred, where they call it the Red Summer, mm-hmm. where many cities were burned, where African Americans owned property, and also they had decent jobs. So you take those two things away, you know there is very little chance to build wealth.
And they were owners. They owned their business and the building that their business was in. They owned a home that was close to that neighborhood. And because they weren't provided with just compensation, some of them, when they relocated, ended up becoming renters.
Very little money in their pocket.
And then became multi-generations in public housing having been an owner.
Even people who own a home and they sell the home for what they think is a lot of money, mm-hmm. and they can't go anywhere else to live, especially if they want to live in the same neighborhood they're living in. They can't afford it. So my thing is this generational wealth that they fool people into believing, and this is just my thought on it, generational wealth, it only comes by, it can't come by just property. It can't come by just money. It has to come by products, continual having something to sell, having something to barter. Because if it's just property and you're not holding on to it, the next generation sells that property off, it's gone. What happened to generational wealth? We have to go back to what Wall Street people were talking about and have that be a community of selling, having something to sell and buy and share. That's what I feel has to be that generational pull.
And I would agree with you. And I think we're still stuck some kind of way. We're placing these silos of, like, for example, right here in Boston, you have the Reggie Lewis Track and Field Center. Okay, great. Okay. And yet, I bet you most people cannot tell me about the other Reginald Lewis that lived in the Boston area and graduated from Harvard Law School and has a building named after him on the campus of Harvard.
They probably don't even know it exists because I don't know it.
Okay.
So they keep a stretch.
And he was a business person.
Yeah.
Becomes the first Black CEO of a major corporation. So this notion that somehow or another, okay, we're in sports, that's great. We're entertainment, that's also great. But also,
we don't do anything else.
But okay. But okay, just in the, unfortunately, he dies young in his 50s, but that he was this CEO comes from humble beginning, what, in Baltimore, if I have my information correct, okay? But most folk right here don't know that he was even here, okay? So how do we change these narratives? When you were talking earlier, Reg, about the stories of what's being shared and what's not being shared, these massacres. And I said I took a Black history course, and I didn't even know about all the massacres.
Okay. I learned Black history in college. Sorry. Okay. No high school.
Okay. So how do we change these narratives that are being told about who we are and what we have accomplished?
What about starting with the books? I mean, do kids, I know, Reggie, you're a teacher. Books, they're getting rid of these books that we are trying to read or we have access to, and they want to put you on the internet and get rid of all that. So it's a control. What do you think about that for the high school students?
Well, they knew books were it's a primary source. So states like Florida and other states and major cities are doing away with some types of books in their curriculum. So we just have to fight and trying to find out which books will be beneficial to our young people. Mm-hmm. So we just got to just keep working. There's always going to be opposition to certain curriculums that are beneficial to our kids, but we just got to keep pushing.
And I think the part that I find a bit troubling is when you're saying, well, share these narratives and you're making certain constituencies feel uncomfortable. Well, I don't know. I think that's part of maturing and growing up, is that there will be things that we learn about, all of us, that we're not comfortable with.
That's cool.
I don't think anybody's saying hate white people because they learn about this. There are things in our history that we can't get to the next level unless we deal with it at an earlier level and be frank about those kinds of conversations.
Yes.
You know, I think the Germans had to really deal with the whole Holocaust matter. And how did they deal with it in their curriculum? In South Africa, these truth and reconciliation commissions that they had back, you know, decades ago about how do we deal with their apartheid past? And so we've got to be open and frank and have those kinds of honest conversations about the past. I think there was more open, though. It's interesting. Some of the stuff you see in the news, I just flat out, I don't understand it. It was more open conversation, I think, when I was in school. Now it's been over 45 years ago I was in high school. So this, we can't talk about it now because somebody's going to feel uncomfortable. I don't understand that. I don't understand.
I know. Back then, they didn't care whether you were uncomfortable. I know. I'm sorry. I have to say, I really feel, and this is my personal opinion, that we need to get back to having black teachers teach black kids. That's just my opinion. I think that they are stop looking at color, they stop looking at bias, and start listening to the teacher. Because I'm there to teach you. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I heard a fact years ago. We're the only culture that turn our kids over to other people to teach.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I said parents. It should every school that parents are in, parents should be made to go to school and spend a day in that class with their student, with their kids. That should be a mandatory, and I guarantee you,
a
lot of that will go away. Sorry, a lot of that stuff will go away. You come one day and spend some time in this school system with your kid. A lot of things would change.
I like that. So, well, at any given time, there'll be multiple parents in the school. I like that. I like that.
And they'll be throwing me out, right?
I like that.
Well, I could see there'd be some pushback from certain, you know, education. Maybe even the education establishment might push back. Now, there was a thing, what was it, Louisiana or something, where the kids were acting up and some
but
of the men and the community went in.
Right.
And they changed that school around.
It has to be. But I got to play my commentary because I made a statement. I got it.
The preceding commentary does not reflect the views of the staff and management of WBCA or the Boston Neighborhood Network. If you would like to express another opinion, you can address your comments to the Boston Neighborhood Network at 3025 Washington Street, Boston, Mass. 02119, attention WBCA LP 102.9 FM. If you would like to arrange a time for your own commentary, call WBCA at 617-708-3241 or email us at radio@bnntv.org.
Yes, you are listening to WBCA LP 102.9 FM, Boston Community Radio, and you're in the Village with Willie P. And we're talking about everything from reparation to Black Wall Street and how it is and how it should be and what's going on. So we're going to continue. We got a couple more minutes we're going to share. I can't believe we done talked. We've talked. I can't believe. So, Reggie, you were saying something?
Well, I'm going to do a shameless plug for one of these subjects that I teach.
Okay.
Financial literacy. That course should be taught in every school in the city, in every grade. Of course, it has to be age appropriate, but I think financial literacy should be taught in every school, in every grade. There's no reason why a student graduates and say, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. They should be exposed to so many careers, so many opportunities by time they're graduate. They should be prepared on making decisions as to what they would like to do. But certainly, I always go back to the one of the principles of Kwanzaa. So this one I'm talking about, UJAMA, cooperative economics. So it talks about teaching economics and things like that in school. If you don't get it in school, there's certain after-school programs. Parents should get involved. But certainly financial literacy is one of the key aspects of education that everyone should go after.
And I'm going to...
Evan?
I got selected to go to South Africa in 2008. 2008, and it was for looking at economic education, financial literacy. And in South Africa in 2008, when I was there, they had already had that throughout the curriculum at every grade level. And all the educators who were selected to go on that trip at that time, there were 14 of us that were selected from throughout the country, they could not believe that the United States, that, you know, sort of is the model for a range of things.
Education.
Okay. A range of things. And you all don't have that in your schools? That's not mandated in your state? And they couldn't believe it. They were, are you serious? And so we visited high schools, we visited middle schools, and we were seeing this. We didn't visit any elementary school. And we were seeing this firsthand in different provinces. We were there for 2 weeks, different provinces throughout the country. And so in Massachusetts, we are now trying to do that. There's mm-hmm. been hearings just, what was it, last month? And there was a segment on TV the other week showing where some districts in Massachusetts do require it as a graduation requirement. But they're few and far between.
Very few. 16. There's a lot of states around Massachusetts that require it, but Massachusetts as a whole do not require financial literacy, which this state is supposed to be, again, the model for education.
Number one for education.
So I don't understand why we don't mandate every student to take financial literacy
as
a graduate.
Do they still have to take the
MCAS and all that?
Did they bar it? I thought they...
No, they still have to take MCAS, okay. But there's a movement to disband that.
Math is probably the lowest subject, so financial literacy, if we can keep them dumb and crazy and not, we'll keep them, because they won't be able to count money. They won't even be able to mm-hmm. know what, I'm giving you 25%. No, I'm giving you 20%. Which is more, $25 off or 20%?
Exactly.
They won't know.
Exactly.
And this is what happens when they bamboozle us.
Exactly.
Out of
applied math should be taught in every grade.
Every grade.
Whatever math that is going on in the world should be taught in school.
Absolutely.
Should be taught. So by the time a student graduates, they should know how to purchase a house. They should know the ins and outs on renting an apartment. They should know how to open up a business. They should know, like, the percentages that you're talking about, so they won't get bamboozled.
And I would say particularly since the metropolitan Boston area is becoming one of the leading metropolitan areas for STEM-type careers, science, technology, engineering, and math. Okay, and yet we're not generating enough from our community right here, particularly people of color, unless they're foreigners who are coming along with the kind of preparation in order to fill those positions. There are some, but there aren't the major numbers that we would hope to, particularly since the greater Boston area is becoming one of the leading areas for STEM careers. Mm-hmm.
Do you see that the Boston public school system is wavering on some systems, or they just can't get it together? I'm just amazed.
Well, whatever the reason is, we're just not preparing our kids for those jobs. Whatever side of the political coin you're on, you'll come up with different reasonings. But I'm just stating a fact that we're not preparing our kids to fulfill those jobs that Kevin talked about.
Right. Or even generating the kind of interest, like you talk about, being made aware of the kind of opportunities that are going to be available for you
if
you do this.
Absolutely.
Not even have awareness of it.
Right. Absolutely. And it goes back to that generational training too, trade, having a trade that you can be responsible for, like plumbers, carpenters. Those are the jobs that are going to get you the business. Because you can go into those business. When you get out of college, you got a college degree. What can you do with it?
Well,
I think
it's interesting you mentioned about the vocational and trades. And I can remember when I was in school and after that, you took an exam. I know some people are hating on exams. You took an exam to get into the technical schools.
Yeah.
Or you couldn't go in. because they needed to know that you can make those switches and those fractions and those decimals and all that, okay, to do it, okay? And now I know some people are hating on exams, and yet we're not producing them. But the other part of it is that the lingering kinds of discrimination, the structural kinds of things that when people do acquire those skills, they can't gain access or entry into those fields. So that still exists. I know some people say, well, no, race doesn't matter. Well, there are some, maybe not the frontal up front kinds of things are not there. But you can put in certain policy. And, well, it's done a lot differently. I worked in banking.
Yeah.
And I see
red lining looks like a different color, right? Yeah. And there, it comes in a different shape, but it's still red lining.
And you're not gonna, but you're not gonna see the very visible signs
of it. They don't tell you no in front of your face; they tell you in the back.
Yeah. I've talked about the land loss, and I didn't say this earlier, was that one of the comments that was made is when you didn't get those loans to hold on to your farm or hold on to your land, or is that a different rate or the amount of collateral that you have to put up to support the back the loan? You know, part of the Pickford case was that, well, the USDA is the last plantation. So forget farm, it's the plantation. And I don't know if you all remember that lady, Shirley Sherrod. She was on TV during the Obama administration. She worked for USDA in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And there's some big something happened and everything like that. And they wanted her out. And then it made such a public mess with the Secretary of Agriculture at that time, who was back in again. Okay. And then she said, no, I don't want the job. Keep the job. No, I'm okay.
We got a couple of more minutes. You want to just wrap up any information you want to share? You got a couple minutes that we can talk about to kind of wrap up.
I always plug financial literacy. So we're going to get back to that on our next segment.
Yes.
So I'm always going to push financial literacy. No matter where I go, I'm always talking about financial literacy, personal finance, what we need to know to go forward. So look forward to that on our next segment. We're going to get back to
it. And having the language, because I noticed when I was in South Africa and those students were taking economic education and financial literacy, whatever they called it in the different communities, they had the language. They knew what mortgage was. They knew what usury laws were. They knew about refinancing. They had the vocabulary. They had the language because they had been exposed to it in school while they were going through school. Mm. So their whole repertoire of understanding financial literacy, now hopefully they're going to put into practice once they graduate, but they had an awareness of it in a way that we don't even, can't even touch. Yeah.
Yeah. When they say knowledge is power, but the use of knowledge is the actual power. So we have to give students that information. Certainly it's up to them, but a lot of our students lack the knowledge. So we have to give them that knowledge so they can go out and put it to good use.
I totally agree. And I know that we're like out of time again. I can't believe it. 30 minutes at this goes very fast. You are listening to WBCALP 102.9 FM, Boston Community Radio. And we've been talking to Kevin Smith and Reggie Pittman. Thank you guys for coming and sharing your wealth of knowledge with us. So we hope to have you back again, right?
Thank you. Hopefully. Right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
To be continued.
All right. You are in the Village with Willie P, and we hope to see you on the next go round. So stay safe and see ya.